Have you ever loved someone so much that you followed them around and talked endlessly about them to all your friends and family? That's how much we love rhododendron, a quirky and amazing genus of flowering plants with a deep human history and an incredible ecological legacy. Follow along on our adventures as we learn about the remarkable things that folks all around the world have done for the love of rhododendron. Greetings, Roto lovers. Juliana here. Just wanted to stop by and say, woohoo! It's our 1 year anniversary. That's right, it was 1 year ago on June 1st that we released our first episode of For the Love of Rhododendron. And in celebration of this day, I'm so excited to be bringing you the final episode of season one. And to announce, drumroll please, season two! Ryan, Christina, Connor, and myself are already hard at work on the next season of Rhododendron Love Stories, and we have a great lineup of interviews with hybridizers, horticulturalists, naturalists, and researchers. Plus, we'll catch up with a few of our favorites from season one. The first episode of season two is set for release on September 1st, 2022. So meanwhile, we hope you enjoy this next episode, and we'll see you soon! Episode 12, As Soon as the Sun Rays Hit. In this episode, Juliana and Ryan meet Dr. Shweta Basnett, who shares stories from her PhD work on the pollination biology of rhododendron in Sikkim, Himalaya. We learn how she left her bed well before dawn to trek up a mountainside and survey many different rhododendron species and their pollinators, including sunbirds, who start drinking the nectar as soon as the sun rays hit the ground, and how the difficult task of climbing a mountain day after day led to stunning views and a chance to expand from local to global rhododendron studies as a Fulbright postdoctoral fellow at the University of Maryland, thus illustrating the words of author William Arthur Ward, "Opportunities are like sunrises. If you wait too long, you'll miss them."
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back to For the Love of Rhododendron. We are here today with Dr. Shweta Basnett to talk about her awesome research on rhododendrons. So let's go. Hi, Shweta. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Ryan. I know this was due for a really long time, but finally we are here. So I'm really excited, looking forward to this.
Yeah, we're really excited to talk with you too. And of course, we're joined by our narrator and podcast creator, Dr. Juliana Medeiros too. Hi, Juliana.
Hi.
Hi, Juliana.
I guess we'll just hop right in. So we wanted to know a little bit more about your exciting dissertation research that you did on rhododendrons in Sikkim. So can you tell us a little bit about the importance of rhododendrons in that region and about the project that you did there?
Yeah, sure. Rhododendron is definitely one of the very interesting and important system for the Himalayan forest. So if you look at the rhododendron distribution in the Himalayas, you'll see them occurring from almost 2200 meter, and it ranges till 4500 meter, which means like they are covering almost every forest type, starting from temperate forest to the alpine meadows. And they are also the first species to flower right after the harsh winters and serve as an important food resource, especially for the pollinators, such as birds and insects. They serve as an important food resource for these myriad forms of birds and insects. And if you look at rhododendron life forms, they usually occur as understory. They are mostly seen as an understory in conifer forest and oak forest. And that again provides an important and interesting habitat for many wildlife. So it does support many endemic wildlife, such as Himalayan black bear, Himalayan mastier, and many different kinds of pheasants. So it has very important role to play as in terms of ecology. Now, apart from that, this genus is also very important to humans. So it offers different services to the people, firstly coming to the provisional services. So rhododendron forest offers like a fuel wood, a timber, and the flower is often used in making wines, squash, pickles, and often used for making medicine used by the local people of the high altitudinal regions. Yeah, so there's a lot of tangible as well as intangible services that rhododendron offers to the people. Now coming to the intangible services, like who wouldn't want to visit the sanctuary filled with rhododendrons? So during the flowering season, so it almost becomes like a visual treat for people. People go to the forest just to enjoy the time with the family, friends. And apart from that, flowering season also attracts a lot of tourists. So that generates a great amount of revenue for the government and also local people, especially those living very close to the or the periphery of the sanctuaries, benefits. Like it definitely uplifts the local employment as well as the economy. So the system has a lot to offer to the people as well as the wildlife or maintaining of overall functioning of the mountain ecosystem in the Himalayan region. Yeah, and coming to the second question about my work. So I've carried out my PhD dissertation on reproductive phenology of rhododendrons. So it's mainly trying to understand what are the drivers which determines the reproductive phenology events. By reproductive phenology events, I mean all the stages starting from budding, flowering, fruiting to fruit dehiscence. So I monitored them for 3 years. So I had a 3 years field work, and the work was carried out in one of the sanctuary located in east part of Sikkim. And I studied this on 10 rhododendron species, which were distributed across the elevation gradient from almost 3,400 to 4,200 meter. So the overall idea was to see what drives this phenological events.
So one of the things that you talked about that I think is surprising for people from the US is what a prominent and critical role rhododendron plays in the ecosystems in Sikkim. So when you think about this tourist dimension, how important do you think that really is in terms of helping to promote the ecological benefits of rhododendron?
So I don't have a straight answer to this. Actually, this is something I've realized is of concern, though rhododendron does affect tourism. So the tourist season in the Himalayas most often falls during that time where there is a very high flowering. So tourists is definitely attracted or they come to see the flowering of rhododendrons. But what these forests are getting in return, that is of concern. Because I'm talking based on my personal experience. So definitely with rise in tourism comes a lot of pollution. Mm-hmm. So the unmanaged or inadequately managed tourism can definitely have a negative impact on the forest. And it's sad, but definitely tourism is not something which is being well managed in the Himalayan region. And that is of big concern. Because I've seen how it has affected the wildlife, how it has polluted the place, you know. It's not that we are against people benefiting from it, because definitely with tourism comes a lot of employment to the local people. And there's something good about the tourism, but definitely there is the unmanaged tourism will definitely lead to a very worse consequences, mainly to the ecosystem. So that is of main concern, I feel.
Yeah, I think a couple of people we've talked to have mentioned the increase in the road surface area over time, going to places in China and the Himalayas, and basically just building more roads has a huge impact. And that's just one aspect of bringing tourists in, is having the road. And then you've got to have more bathrooms, and you've got to have, you know, waste is generated. So there's this huge impact. So while on the one hand, I think in the US, a lot of people want to view ecotourism as being a solution for conservation. It has this cost, and it's unclear, I think, when it balances and when the cost is worth the benefits that you're getting. So it's a tough question.
It is a tough question, but also tourism, especially for the Himalayan range, is important because there are definitely people who require employment, and because flowering does provide livelihood to the people in the Himalayan range. And by stopping tourism, we are again prohibiting them from getting those benefits. So I feel the good solution would be definitely government should think of like how much of the people they would like to bring in every season, because there is no proper count on how much tourists can this particular place sustain, right? We need to have more of a very sustainable policies where people like working on the rhododendron, more informed scientists, more different stakeholders, I would say, like the forest department, the people, local people who are getting benefited should come together and come up with a more sustainable practices with regard to tourism.
Yeah, that is, like as you stated, a really interesting but also challenging problem. And to Juliana's point, like just my travels in China and comparing, you know, my stories with my advisor who was there in like the late 90s, early 2000s. The Hunguan Mountains in Yunnan and Sichuan, China, become so much more accessible for all sorts of people. So like there, I think almost everywhere we drove, there were paved roads. There wasn't very much dirt road driving or hiking off trail. And, you know, we were able to access a lot of different rhododendron sites. And you just think about, yeah, it brings a lot of resources and good things to that part of China, but it's also, there's also increased development and outside interest from different parts of the country. And also wealthier, you know, people are moving in and kind of displacing the native people who have been there for so long and have a more intimate connection with wildlife and nature in that area. So it's going to be a challenging outlook for a lot of rhododendron species and other parts of life in those regions.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think so. We have a very clear answer to this. It's much more complex. And whatever you have explained, almost the scenario is very similar to the place where I've worked. So definitely it's challenging, and we don't have a one single answer to how we could solve this.
Did you have a lot of sites during your PhD that were pretty remote, or did you have, you know, pretty direct access to your sites where you were surveying?
So my work had a lot to do with the flowering timing. So it wasn't possible for me to have field sites located far away, or many field sites. It would be very difficult for me to monitor. So ideal thing was to just focus on one place, which gives a very good gradient, elevation gradient, and there's a lot of co-occurring species, and focus on that area. But I had to trek a lot, I mean, quite a lot. So yeah, trekking was fun, but especially when I had to do more of the pollinators observation, it was a difficult task. Yeah, so I just focused on one particular area.
And that had a 2,000 meter elevation range. So when you say trekking, you're talking about literally like climbing up a mountain every day.
Oh yes, it was. It was quite an adventure. So as the flowering progresses, me trekking higher up was like, you know, early morning, just wake up and then you know how much I had to trek. So I had in my mind. So accordingly, I had to plan my work and wake up much earlier. So the higher mountain, if I had to sample, I had to wake up almost 1 hour prior to the usual timing. So because I had to reach there on time. So it was quite a task. But the view itself is so stunning. So once you reach the point, once you reach the spot, you forget everything. It was all worth it. So that's how it was.
Yeah. You know, in my field, we do something called pre-dawn water potential, where you wake up at like 2 a.m. and you go out with equipment and you measure plant water status. And I always tell people your reward is the sunrise, because you will never see a better sunrise than the one you see when you got up really early in the morning to do some data collection. It's just, you do get that almost secret moment that you would never get any other way. So it's definitely, it's
I look forward to that. Even when I'm waking up at 2 a.m., I'm like, oh, gonna see that great sunrise in a little while.
Yeah. For me, interestingly, I used to encounter a lot of wildlife because that early morning phase, they're very active. So yeah, it was interesting to come across many, like, not Himalayan black bear, but usually the musteers and the monal, Himalayan molan, just very beautiful. So yeah, I used to usually, I mean, almost every day I visit, I used to encounter them during my field work. Just because of the timing.
Yeah, they weren't expecting you. They thought you'd be sleeping.
And I think you get a lot more of the bird life too earlier in the morning, right? Or no?
Of course. You know? Of course. So. Yeah. Birds are one of the important pollinators. So they just start the activity as soon as the sun rays hits the ground. Like, they will be super active. So especially during the winters, almost for 5, you'll see 5 a.m., you'll see birds very active. So during the flowering season, it used to be almost around 6 a.m. I used to reach the spot. So that's when they used to start the activity.
That's really interesting. I actually had one question that you mentioned while you were talking about your project. And in particular, I was reading this in a manuscript that I was reviewing for our lab, who are doing some ecological, like, co-species existence patterns in China. And it was a sentence that you said that rhododendron as a genus tends to flower a little bit earlier in the season than other plants of, like, the Sikkim Himalaya or, you know, Sino-Himalayan area. And so I was just thinking, what are your thoughts on that in terms of, you know, as like an evolutionary unit, so to speak, of rhododendron adapting to earlier phenology than other plants that they, you know, might have to compete with other pollinators?
What I can tell about, based on my experience, is so the flowering phenology event is very extremely sensitive to temperature. So over the period, like, almost for many years, even our elders used to say, like, onset of flowering means, okay, the spring has begun, the temperature is rising. So that used to be the indicator of flowering of rhododendrons in the hills. So I believe they're very sensitive to the rise in temperature, and that's when they start blooming. And that's, you're right, that's what I have observed during my field sites. They are the first species to just bloom. 2 or 3 degree rise in temperature means, yeah, rhododendron starts blooming. So they are extremely sensitive. And that's why that makes them, again, very vulnerable to the future rise in temperature.
That's kind of a good segue into our next question. Juliana, it looks like you were about to ask a question though.
Well, I got excited and I skipped around because that's, you know.
That's okay.
I'm wondering, I wanted to ask more about the birds on the dissertation because I think that, and I'll just ask it. So in your dissertation work, you have a lot of data on bird pollinators and you've mentioned the birds a lot. And I think in the US, this is a surprise because in the US, I think people think of bees as being the pollinators of rhododendron. So could you just talk a little bit about the birds, some of the birds that you observed, like, what was your favorite bird? What is the importance of rhododendron for birds specifically versus insects? Because I think it's new to us here in the US.
Okay, that's new to me. I mean, what you explained about the US, and it's quite important since I'll be doing the fieldwork here. Okay, now coming to the Himalayan region. So what I've observed is birds serve as an important pollinators for rhododendrons occurring in the lower elevations. So as I told you, I have covered from 3,400 to almost 42. So somewhere in 3,800 meter elevation, you will see the tree line. So those species occurring below the tree line were mostly pollinated by birds. And among birds, sunbird, the fire-tailed sunbird, is one of the very dominant or common pollinators. So they are nectarivorous birds as well as insectivorous birds. Now, interestingly, what I observed was the insectivorous birds usually come to feed on insects, which again are rhododendron pollinators such as flies. And in this activity, they also land up pollinating the flowers. So they are actually not just coming for the nectars. It's mostly for the insects, which pollinates them. But they are other sets of nectarivorous birds, which just comes to feed on the nectars, and among which sunbird is the important one. When I talk about the non-nectarivorous birds, it's mostly warblers and thrushes. You'll also get to see finches in some of the cases. But finches, it's mostly seen slightly higher elevation. The lower elevation, it's mostly warbler. And Julia is well aware that I did some field work in Barsi, which is again in much lower elevation compared to where I did my PhD field work. So Barsi is in temperate forest. Barsi is in temperate forest. And where I did my field work, those were like the alpine and the subalpine regions. And what I saw in a temperate forest was exactly what I was assuming to see. So there was even more bird pollinators in the temperate. So it seemed that as we move towards a much lower elevation, bird becomes one of the active pollinators. And when you observe the flowers, also there's a very close association with the floral characteristics and the birds, the kind of bird groups, you know, there is a very good relationship between the floral characters and the bird groups which visit these plants. So definitely they have evolved in such a way that they favor only bird pollinators, especially in the lower belt, but in the higher elevation, it's visited more by bumblebees and some flies as well. Yeah, but I'm again curious to see what kind of pollinators I'm going to come across here. But when I was doing my work, like trying to select some of the species, I didn't find much variation in the floral traits. It was almost of a similar kind, though we don't have much species here. I think it's almost 30 species in North America. And there was not high diversity like what we see in the Himalayas. Of course, we have more species and it's more obvious to see the high diversity. But here, it was more of a very similar kind of morphologically. Though there were diversity in colors, but the flower morphology was quite similar. But I'm eager to explore how and see what other pollinators are.
There was a neat paper about buzz pollination of rhododendron, or maybe it was wing flap pollination. I'll have to find that for you. But it was basically like a weird mode. You know about it, Ryan?
I think with like a lot of the ones that are kind of open and have, you know, really long anthers in the flowers that you see. I'm forgetting the name of one of the American species that I'm talking about. But is like it, subsection.
So I've ahead, read sorry. About it. Yeah, I've read about it. But interestingly, I did not come across even a single butterfly visiting rhododendron in those 10 species. Or for now, like I can still add the other two species, other five species, what I've observed in Barsi. So among almost 15 species, I have not come across even a single butterfly. So they just visit, but they don't pollinate, you know? So
interesting. Yeah, that was wing pollination. See, I should probably think about my facts before I talk about them. It was wing pollination. That's right.
Wing pollination. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're going to have a lot of fun looking at rhododendrons here because I think you're going to be surprised at what's different and what's the same. When you talk about birds being at the lower elevations, I wonder if we're just missing lower elevation rhododendrons and that's why we don't have bird pollination.
Yeah. Possibly.
It could be true. And it also may be that we just also don't have as high a density of bird species packing in the mountains either. Like a lot of our birds here in North America are migrants. And so, you know, we have hummingbirds out west, but we don't have sunbirds here or anything like that, right? So hummingbirds out west are going to be visiting a lot of flowers, but usually a lot of those hummingbirds are, you know, kind of lower elevation desert type, you know, drier, more xeric habitats. There are some higher elevation hummingbirds, but whether or not they visit rhododendrons, I don't know. I think we just kind of have a mismatch in where we have kind of nectivorous birds and rhododendron species. So I don't know. I bet you'll find something surprising with the birds.
Yeah.
Flowers. They always do. But whether or not they're really having an impact on pollination is hopefully something you'll be able to see.
Yeah, I'm eagerly looking forward to this.
I think one of the most striking rhododendrons that I've ever seen is the Cinnabarinum or Cinnabarinum. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but one of the species that, yes, that's one of my favorite rhododendrons. I just, like, as soon as you see it, you're like, oh, that's, you know, that's a bird pollinated flower, right? It has to be. It kind of has that.
That is loved by sunbird. That's sunbird's favorite flowering species.
Wow. I call that species cinnamon bears because it makes me feel happy and good and joyful. And cinnamon bears also make me feel joyful. So to know that sunbirds love cinnamon bears rhododendron, that makes me happy.
it's such a beautiful species. When I was collecting it in Seattle at Federal Way Botanic Garden there, I just remember I think I was down on one knee with my plant press and I looked up and the sun was shining directly behind the flower. Okay. So you just got the, you know, they talk about the globe or the, you know, the, like the Helios type sunshine ring that you can see through flowers. And I got a firsthand view of that. And so I took one of the flowers off and there was so much nectar inside of the flowers that I had to empty the flowers themselves before pressing the specimen because I didn't want mold and stickiness from the, so I literally had to take the branch that I cut off and like, you know, slap it down like a mop on the ground and watch all the nectar come flying out of this plant that's, you know, thousands of miles away from any of its favorite pollinators. It's just a really interesting
species. Talking about the nectars, so it reminded me, like, it was a big task for me to measure the nectar of Cinnabarinum because it never used to get over. I had to keep measuring it. It used to be like so high compared to other species and I had to take the count properly. And it never used to get over. Like for one single floret, I used to spend almost 5-10 minutes trying to see how much nectar it has. So mostly the lower altitude species has very high nectar volume, but the concentration is low. But as you go to the higher elevation, the nectar volume decreases and it becomes very sticky. It becomes more concentrated. So nectar is a very interesting trait in terms of rhododendron to study.
Interesting. You know, we have a project where we were looking at rhododendron floral traits and we meant to measure nectar at the rhododendron species garden. And we didn't because we didn't have time, but this makes me doubly want to go and do that because do the species from higher elevation have that same difference in a common garden? Now I'm dying to know. I have a feeling this is going to be bad for my, I have a task of not doing any more new projects. And I have a feeling this is bad for that because I'm just getting excited about all the different things that you're doing. So I'm glad you're doing it because then I don't have to worry about trying to do it. I'll just say, oh, she's doing it. So
yeah, I will be measuring nectar.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was, I think reading about some of your work early on in my dissertation made me really want to work on pollination in rhododendron. I ended up not doing that, obviously, but it is something that, you know, if I stay in the research realm, I would love to get involved with because I think there's just so many interesting transitions from, you know, from like bee pollinated to like moth pollinated in some parts of China to, you know, farther into the areas that you've studied where you talk about all this crazy bird pollination and there's just so many interesting things. There's like so many species packed into this one geographic area. And they're all doing so many different things. It's just really interesting to try to unravel all their different stories.
It is a very interesting system, I guess. The more you know about it, it's a model system to test many hypotheses. That's what I feel, you know, there's so many scope to learn and use this as a model system.
Okay, so in terms of temperature rise, you know, or global climate change, as we call it, or rapid warming, you know, that you spoke a lot about these higher elevation rhododendrons, and I work on alpine rhodies myself. So we're kind of curious, you know, the Himalayan region in general, plus Sikkim, what kind of things have you learned from your research about the conservation of alpine rhododendrons and what kind of challenge they face with climate change?
Okay, so So one of the objectives was definitely to understand the relationship between the temperature and the flowering timing. And though we have been hearing like, yeah, rhododendron is very sensitive to temperature, but from that landscape, we did not have any evidence. We did not have field-based data. And that was the work which I carried out was one of those field-oriented or field-based data, which showed, yeah, the species are responding to the rising temperature. And but interestingly, what more I contributed was trying to link it with the evolutionary history. So it was seen that the flowering event itself has a very high phylogenetic signal, or it shows a very high phylogenetic signal among the closely related species, which means that the related species are all flowering at the same time. And in fact, their response to temperature is also very same. Now, we can then expect that with the rise in temperature, it's not just one species or two species that is going to get affected, but we can expect that the entire clade of the closely related species may later face similar threat, right? Because definitely these species are responding to temperature. With the rise and any fluctuation in temperature, they are going to, we are going to see some kind of shifts in the flowering timing. And we can expect that the entire related set of species belonging to the certain clade will respond in a similar way. So that was one of the interesting things what I found out. And again, another topic would be with regard to the floral clade, especially the nectar. Now, when I talk about the high altitude species, which are found mostly above the tree line. Now, these are species, the morphology is such that only bees or insects with a longer proboscis can have access to the rewards, right? So, and even the birds, even if they reach to the higher elevation, they will not be able to pollinate this small, very small flowers, right? So they will definitely lose the potential pollinators if they are not able to meet with the phenology of the pollinators, right? Of course, there is the reduction of the habitat, high altitude habitat, and definitely they won't have much more space to expand the distribution. That idea is still there. But what I'm saying is even to meet the potential pollinators would be very difficult in terms of the rising temperature in such scenarios, especially for the high altitude species. Now, in terms of low altitude species, morphology is such that insects as well as a bird can have access to the rewards, but they can still benefit from any kind of pollinators. Though birds seems to be a more common visitor, but even the insects can go and pollinate them. So that will give them advantage to expand the distribution. And what I've noticed is the low elevation, wide ranging species are very plastic in their traits. I've seen them being pollinated by birds in the low elevation, and then in the higher altitudes, the characteristic is such that they mimic the characteristics of insects being pollinated by bumblebees. So they have a much higher nectar concentration, you know? So I feel over the period of time, if there is a extreme rise in temperature, we will definitely lose the diversity of higher elevation rhododendrons, which are there mostly in the high altitude. And maybe those species which are having very wide range, they are going to dominate the system. Maybe we'll lose all the diversity, but definitely few of these species are going to expand and dominate the landscape. That's what I understood from my work.
Yeah, that's interesting. You have to think that there's been oscillations of this type of extinction and expansion for different habitats throughout time with glaciation already. I think a lot about that with my own work, and some of the genetic patterns that we're uncovering makes it very complex when you have alpine plants that kind of get restricted to the tops of mountain ranges, and then during warmer times, you know, they may expand. Or I guess, sorry, the other way around. When it's warmer, they get pushed to the tops of the mountains. And then when it gets colder, they push themselves down the mountains as you know, things around them are cold and are more to their liking environmentally. And then when it reverses again and they have to push back, they may have traveled to another mountain range and intermixed with species that are closely related to them. which makes the genetic patterns really complex. So I don't know if, you know, that might provide some sort of genetic rescue, so to speak, what we talk about with being able to be more adaptive to certain climate challenges. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Maybe I will be able to answer this question after I do more work on my postdoctoral research, because here I'll be looking at my work is more at the global scale. So I will be definitely able to speak more on this maybe a little later. Now, so I have literally moved from the local scale where I've just focused on 10 rhododendron species. So I've answered very, very fundamental questions. Now with that understanding, I'm taking it further to the global level. So yeah, maybe much later I'll have a better understanding to this.
Okay, fingers crossed. I'll come back and ask you again.
I really like this point though, because I think when I think about climate change and rhododendron, I think a lot of people get pretty depressed. But I have found a lot of value in thinking about the fact that they've actually been through this before in a lot of sense. And so it's not doomsday. It's not complete doomsday. I think everything we know about them is probably likely to be impacted. But I think there's a lot of hope that there are going to be rhododendrons that are going to be able to negotiate. And I really like what you said about the lower elevation plants that have a broader range and being very flexible in their traits. If you could make a plant for climate change, that would be what you would make, right? So I think we should take away some sense of hope. I think there's always that sense that we could definitely keep doing more to make sure that our impacts are light, but nature is resilient. Evolution is a process of change and resilience. So I think what you have told us is a hopeful note.
Yeah, I too agree. Like some species are really going to spread across and we might lose the diversity, but it's not that. And again, one important take-home message from my work was not every species is going to respond in a similar way. Because I have just covered maybe 1,000 more, slightly more than that elevation. And even in that range, I could see the variation, like immense variation in every aspect, from phenology to floral traits to leaf traits, everything. So you can imagine Himalayas where rhododendron occurs from 2,200 to 4,500, how diverse it is and how diversely, you know, each rhododendron species may respond to climate. It requires a lot of study. And I feel sad, like sometimes, or most of the times, you just come up with a conservation strategy, which is, again, applied to all rhododendrons. And you don't realize, no, they are different. And each habitat is different. They are not going to respond in a similar way. We need to have a specific strategy for each of these species occurring in different habitats. There's a lot of things to be looked at.
I think that's a super important point in terms of, at the very beginning, you mentioned the human importance. I think a lot of times in the US, when you look at what people know about rhododendron, it's often what they know about the garden plants. And I think they love the diversity, but then it doesn't translate into the fact that their diversity, it's almost mind-blowing. When you get out in the field there and you're on the side of the mountain and you see nothing but these plants for literally as far as the eye can see, and you know that each individual has some small little tweak on a theme, I think that's something that we can bring to people who appreciate rhododendrons and help them understand through this type of research. So I'm super excited that you're sharing it with us, because we have a lot of listeners that are gardeners. And I think a lot of the things that you have said will kind of blow their minds and they'll have a fresh perspective on it. And to me, that's going to be the heart of how we make these big sort of intractable changes, is each individual person coming to that realization of the role that they can play. And I hope the diversity gets conserved in these gardens. I hope that there's like a light of hope that we've got a lot of genetic diversity of rhododendron all over the world in people's gardens and in botanical gardens. So hopefully we're going to keep it and we can make those steps that we need to make sure that it's enjoyed for generations. So
yeah, this is a very valid point. Actually, this is something which I was also thinking while writing the proposal, maybe to support my fieldwork. So one thing what I noticed after coming here was the home gardens. And I was amazed to see every home garden has one LKC, either azalea or rhododendrons. So that is something so new to me. And we are there in Himalayas with so much of diversity, but still now rhododendron is considered as a wild plant. People don't have it in their home gardens. Apart from rhododendron arboreum, no one even think of planting those in their home gardens. It's still considered as a wild plant. But here, I see it everywhere. I'm just waiting it to flower. So that was the one point. Since they have it in their home gardens, I was thinking how much it could contribute to the native pollinator network, you know? So maintaining the native pollinator, if they grow more of the native plants among, so that will help them maintain a good native pollinator network. That was something that was in my mind as well, while looking at how important the gardens, the home gardens are here. And how, I mean, rhododendron plays an important role too. Something interesting message to take away from here, I feel like, because rhododendron can grow very easily in the native, especially the Himalayas, especially those elevation where they can occur, people can definitely consider them as a very good home gardens. Instead of planting all those exotic plants, why not plant rhododendrons? So this is something, yeah, interesting.
What do you think that is? What's the difference between wanting to plant more exotic species and not, you know, the diversity of rhododendrons that are native to that region for garden plants? I mean,
it's sad to say, but it's also the ignorance. Even for me, till I got into the research, I was not aware of the diversity of rhododendrons. So for them, mostly if you ask any of the locals in the Himalayas, for them, the rhododendron is Rhododendron arboreum, the red flowering plants that is prominent also mostly in the lower belt where people usually do see the more population of people living towards the lower elevation. So they can really relate to arboreum, but the more diverse forms, diversity is seen in the mid and the higher elevation. So people are not aware of it. So there is a lot of, what to say, lack of information, and also more, they do require kind of understanding of how diverse this system is and how much resources we do have in this area. You know, that's how it is. It's sad, but that's the reality.
Yeah, that is really interesting. How similar are the lower elevation gardens where people are growing plants in terms of, you know, like temperature, soil, etc., to kind of the, you know, peak elevational diversity for rhododendrons, which I think in the Hungdwan Mountains is somewhere around like 3,500 to 3,600 meters is where you find, you know, the most rhododendrons. And a lot of that type of microhabitat can be found in places like the United Kingdom and Britain and you know, in Seattle and the Pacific Northwest and things like that. So a lot of those species are easily grown in those areas. But, you know, like some of the alpine Lapponica species that I tried to collect from Steve Hootman and Seattle looked really bad. they were having a really hard time. You know, you'd find a little shrub that had maybe 10 to 20 leaves left on the whole plant. You know, they just are not doing well even at and they've been to, you know, they grow at 4,000 plus meters usually is like their best growing conditions for some of those species. So yeah, I guess my question is, how dissimilar do you think people have a challenge growing some of those rhododendrons, or maybe they've tried?
No, it is not possible for them to bring in high elevation rhododendron to the lower belt. It's mostly with regard to the temperatures, abiotic factors. It will not support, because you will immediately see drop in the temperature, and within almost 300 meter rise, you will face maybe 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius drop. or even more. So definitely that would not favor. But even the people living in that particular elevation, for example, if you see rhododendron in the mid elevation, even the mid elevation people would never grow rhododendron, the mid elevation rhododendron in the home garden. So that is my point here. So they have not realized that.
You mentioned that you didn't know about rhododendron being diverse until you started studying them. How did you get interested in rhododendron? What was the impetus for that?
So I got introduced to rhododendron when I started as a researcher, as more as a field biologist, I would say. So I joined ATRI, Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and Environment, where I did my PhD. So I joined them in 2010 as a junior research fellow. And so that project actually gave me the opportunity to explore various sanctuaries across the Sikkim. So that's when I saw, oh, there are something so attractive and diverse in our place. So the more and more I started understanding the system, learning, reading, the more I got interested. And it's also because I come from a biotechnology background, which is more of a lab focused. So I never got opportunity to, based on my learnings or my college bachelor's and master's, what I did, it was more of a lab based. So I never got introduced to the nature, I would say. So that was the first time where I was getting exposed to the forest, the different sanctuaries, the different habitat, the biodiversity, what we had in our state. So the more learnings and more exposure I got, that's what got me interested in.
I guess thank goodness for places like ATRI. I've looked into ATRI quite a bit, and we're going to put a link to that on our webpage for this podcast. I think it's a really, really cool organization, and I'm glad that I learned about it, because that's the kind of organization I think will contribute to conservation by educating people, by having research taking place. And these are, in some ways, they feel like small steps on a day-to-day basis, but these are the types of organizations that really actually end up making a huge difference. So we'll put a link to that so everybody can learn more about it.
That would be nice. I think ATRI has been doing amazing work, especially in the Himalayan region. I think they have contributed a lot in conserving biodiversity in the region. And they have not only plants, it's different issues altogether, from water to almost everything, different social issues, economic issues. I think they have done amazing work, especially in the Himalayan region.
I heard someone told me that there are not really botanical gardens in India as we think of them in the US and the UK. And that it seems to me like a place like ATRI is fulfilling that same role. Can you talk a little bit about that?
No, that is my also one of my concerns that I have of my reason that we don't have a botanical garden. The amount of biodiversity we have, and it's sad that people have not thought about it, at least in the Northeast, which is one of the most diverse region in India, and we don't have a single botanical gardens there. So I don't know, I hope the things changes. Then we just have it, the close by would be in Kolkata, but yeah, Kolkata cannot support the kind of biodiversity what we have. It's a mountain region, we need to have a garden, especially for the mountain floras located in the mountain region. I hope someone listens to this and takes it further.
There is one of my favorite members of the ARS did make his own botanical garden in Finland. So there are people out there who are uniquely poised to do that. So if you're listening, Shweta can tell you where to go. And she can help you pick your plants. So give her a call.
It could also be because most of our land belong to the government. Like I have seen here, like there are many private landowners have huge areas and they have their own gardens. Like when I wanted help regarding the sampling locations for my the work here in North America, like I got many offers from people who had huge gardens. Like I'm surprised it was all private gardens, and we don't have such. it all belongs to the government. So only if government wants, we can have those kinds of botanical gardens and ideas.
You know, you're a Fulbright fellow now, which congratulations, that's awesome. We wanted to know a little bit more about what your project is for the North American species. I know we've kind of hinted at it. So people are probably like, oh, what's Shweta doing in the US? Like, what is she going to do with our rhododendrons? So can you tell us more about that?
So my work is mainly at the global scale out here. I will be working on the existing phylogeny and trying to understand how the abiotic factors and the biotic, the pollinators have driven the evolution of the genus rhododendron. And now when I talk of the biotic factors where I'm considering rhododendrons and how pollinators have contributed in the evolution of rhododendron, I need to have pollinators data. But sadly, till now, based on the published literature, we have pollinators data for less than 10% of the total rhododendron. And most of them comes from China and India and other parts of the Asian region. But we hardly have any information or very little information from the Western countries. So before I start this work, I definitely need to have a proper field-based understanding of the pollinators for North America. And that's where I'm doing this field work to collect information on the traits, but most importantly on the pollinators, to understand what are the pollinators of rhododendrons, native rhododendrons found here. So that is what my field work is all about here. Yeah, after that, then I'll be carrying further the central questions, which is more about the evolution of rhododendron, which again, I will be addressing using more of an integrated approach. So I'll be using more of a geospatial analysis, molecular phylogenetics and ecological methods to answer the question. So there's a lot to do.
You'll probably start your field work, your observational field work soon, then I would imagine.
Yes. So the plan is to start very soon. But again, I have this funding constraints like every other researchers would have, and I'm working on that. But it's interesting. This time I've spent looking at the distribution, and it seems like the North Carolina has a high diversity of rhododendron, and there's a very good overlap in its occurrence. So I'm considering Carolina and Maryland because it's very accessible, and other focus would be on North Carolina.
It is famous for its rhododendrons, so, and also the many species up in elevation. So I think that sounds like a super fun project.
Yeah, I saw that. It's a very interesting place.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have work. Like rhododendron festivals. So
like, yeah, I came across that. So it was interesting to see, because we do have rhododendron festivals in the Himalayas during the flowering season. And when I was looking at the literature here, it was interesting to see. So North Carolina and maybe some more neighboring states also have, they celebrate their rhododendron festival. So it was interesting to learn.
I love being a researcher and visiting other countries. I feel like you're going to get such a flavor of the United States here that people wouldn't get if they came as a tourist, because you see the real side, you see the problems, you see the hidden gems. So I'm excited for you. And I think that's going to be gorgeous views, the Smoky Mountains. I mean, gorgeous views. So I'm excited for you.
I'm looking forward to it.
So, okay. We have two more questions. I'm sure you're getting a little tired of the hot seat.
No, okay. I think I'm enjoying this conversation.
Good. Awesome. I'm definitely enjoying it. So this is a question we try to ask everybody. What is the strangest or most interesting thing you have ever done for the love of rhododendron?
Well, actually, I've had many experiences because I've spent 3 years in the field. And so I had to spend really long time in the field. So because as I said earlier, I was covering the reproductive phenology, which means budding to fruit dehiscence. So most of the time I used to be there from April till early December. There was one incident, it was again related to pollinators. So we had decided, I mean, my supervisor, I worked with Subhadra Devi, and so we decided that, okay, the sampling will be just for the day pollinators. We want to look at the nocturnal, because she knew how the logistic was and how difficult the area was. And highest point, the sampling location was not very far from China. It was just 2 kilometers away. So we were sharing the international borders. So knowing all this, she said, okay, just leave, chuck the nocturnal pollinators, just focus on this. But me being a curious researcher, I was interested to know what visits them at night. And then I decided with my field assistant, and his name is Sona. He's been with me throughout the all throughout the 3 years I've been there. And so I just had one field assistant with me throughout my work, but it was a night visit and we had to be very careful and cautious. And so I asked him to get 2 more members from the village. So, and relatively more strong, because I wanted them for more for the safety, nothing else, not for the science. So he got 2 members and then we went to the forest. So it was like a valley. The sampling was in a valley. So you can imagine there's a valley and then there is a mountain cliff towards surrounding the valley. So you have army camps across the elevation gradient. Actually, the areas what I've sampled, those are not open to the civilians. It's only army area. So I had to get a special permit. So the civilians out there during those times, it's just me and my field assistant. And of course, so they would not allow us to do field work during night. So, but still I got the permission from the headquarters that, okay, I'll be sampling this time, this day, and I'm here. So yeah, we went, 4 of us. So each of us had a torch, like head torch and hand torch. We had 4 torches with 8 torches all together, and we did our work. It went smooth for 1 hour. Then all of a sudden from the hilltop, there's an announcement being made for one of the army camp who did not get this information that I'm sampling there. And then he's announcing that, okay, whoever's there, you have to surrender, or else we are going to take an action. And these 2 people whom I'd got for my safety, they were scared like any normal human being would be. And they switched off their torch and they went hiding behind the rock. And then looking that the torch is switched off, they become even more suspicious. So it was then Sonam, who was actually the youngest among 4 of us, he made a very smart move. He said, no, we can't do this. And I was like totally frozen. I didn't know what to do. And he asked us to, okay, we have to switch on the torch. And he gave them a signal that, okay, now we are coming there. So just wait. So it took us some time to reach the mountain top. And as soon as he saw me, I mean, those army, they knew me. They knew my face at least. They were like, you started coming here at night. You were here throughout the day. And what made you come here at night? You cannot do this. And they were also concerned because of my safety, because there's a lot of human wildlife conflict. There's a lot of bear attacks, Himalayan black bears out there. So after looking at me, then they canceled everything. And I was not allowed to enter that area during the nighttime. So that time it was very scary. And I don't know, it was a very scary moment. But now looking back, I think it was a lot of adventure, I feel. I mean, a lot of memories I've made in doing the field season. So that was one interesting moment to share.
Yeah, that's quite the story.
Yeah. I had a similar sort of experience in Mexico with army camps and lights and permissions. And that just, it strikes me that that's something that, like you said, it was scary in the moment, but boy, what a story, what a life experience. You can't really replace that with any, you know, trip to the mall does not no. cut it after that. That's very cool.
So did you see any nocturnal pollinators?
Yeah, there were some moths visiting, though they were not very active. They would not move around a lot, yeah, I saw quite a few of them. There were some hawk moths.
Okay, interesting. Because I know like a lot of the bigger flowered Medinia species that I'm familiar with are quite fragrant, you know, and usually bigger white flowers. So I've always been curious about nocturnal pollinator surveys on some of these more like lower elevation subtropical rhododendrons in Southeast Asia.
But they were not moving as actively as bumblebees and flies. Even flies and birds. But I don't know, I didn't get much time to study them. But as much as I could see them, like, they were not moving a lot. And I don't know how much they would contribute to the pollination. But yeah, there were quite a few visits by nocturnal moths.
So cool. So the last thing we want to know is a little bit more about you. Can you tell us a little about you outside of rhododendron? Like, what are your hobbies? What do you like to do, you know, for fun?
So I enjoy both outdoor and indoor activities. So when I'm home, I like home decor. I don't know. I just like decorating the house. And I also have fascination towards the home gardens. I like taking care of plants. So if there's plant, I can spend entire day just doing something with watering them, taking care of the plants. So I can completely spend my entire day with the plants. And if I'm outdoor, I enjoy trekking. I enjoy physical activities. I like to run. Yeah, these are the four important things like I usually do. I enjoy doing this. But yeah, and I also enjoy taking pictures. I like photography. It's because I've spent a lot of time very close to nature and doing the field works. And the photography has become one of the most interesting, fascinating work to do only because of the field work I did and the time I've spent in the forest. I really enjoy taking pictures.
That kind of goes along with the love of home decor, though, because good photographs are about composition, about balance, you know, a little color here, a little color there. So I also love home decor. I love creating scenes, you know, having a colorful object balanced by, and so I could see how photography, it's almost the same flavor, you know, because you're working with the scene and you're trying to get it in the right. So that's very interesting.
I can relate to what you said.
Yeah, and I can attest that you have really, really nice pictures. You take amazing photographs. So
thank you so much.
Continue sharing those with us.
Yeah.
I did have one last question that I'm curious about, because you've spent so much time with so many different rhododendrons. Is there any one that, like, you always picture in your mind, or is one that, like, has given you really good memories? So you're always like, that particular species is my favorite.
Yeah, I love all of them. I cannot pick one. It's when I think of rhododendron, I see all the colors in front of me. I cannot pick one. I think each one has its own importance, its own essence, the way they look and the way they are contributing. So I feel I can't be biased towards one. I love all of them.
All of them is the correct answer.
they each have their own little personalities, for sure.
Yeah, it does.
I have really enjoyed talking to you. This is the first time we're speaking sort of a close by. I've spoken to you a lot over Zoom from India. So now you're in Maryland. You're just like a hop, skip, and a jump away.
Oh, yes.
I hope that we get to meet in person sometime this year. I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm really looking forward to all of the people who love rhododendron in the US getting to learn about your work and learn this really new dimension, I think, for us about your work. So thank you for talking to us. It's been really fun.
Oh, yes. I think the same goes to from my side as well. I remember interacting with you for so many years. I mean, at least the 2 years now. And I was always in India. Now I feel I'm a bit more close. It would be fun to meet you. Definitely, I would love to meet and interact more on the rhododendron research. Yeah, and I'm definitely looking forward to this fieldwork, meet new people. And it'll be fun to contribute more towards the conservation of American rhododendrons, you know. So it's different learning for me altogether. So I'm very excited.
Yeah, I echo all the same sentiments that Juliana said. I hope I get to meet you as well. And it would be great to get some sort of like field report from you at some point during the year, just to hear how things are going and learn a little bit about what you've seen. That'd be so cool to hear about that.
Of course. I'll definitely update about the interesting findings I'll come across. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
Awesome.
Curious to learn more about the topics discussed in this episode? Visit our website at www.rhododendron.org. Here, you'll find tons of rhododendron resources, including tutorials, blogs, events, databases, and more. Click on the podcast link on the homepage to find more episodes, to suggest a topic for a future episode, and to get in-depth information about the people, places, and plants featured here. Until next time, keep carrying that torch for rhododendron, and don't forget to talk endlessly about this podcast to all your friends and family.